Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really monumental subject, the Imperial Palace Complex, known across the world as the Forbidden City.
Mm-hmm.
We're digging into the core insights from Nigel Cameron's, definitive work on this incredible piece of architecture and really political theater.
Yeah, it's a fascinating study of power and place. And it's probably important to say right off the bat, Cameron's book focuses squarely on the Imperial Palace in Beijing, China.
Right.
That's the one, the ultimate symbol of, you know, land-based, ritualistic, divine authority, an authority that lasted for, 500 years?
Incredible. And as we unpack this immense center of gravity, we're also going to be drawing some parallels, looking sideways a bit.
Yeah.
Our sort of mission here is to understand how the architecture, the ritual, everything in Beijing was just meticulously engineered to prop up the mandate of heaven, and what that might tell us about all key historical hubs. We're thinking especially about maritime centers, like the Malacca Sultanate.
Mm.
How does a physical space become the nucleus of a whole civilization's worldview?
It's a great question. We're essentially using maybe the most famous Forbidden City as a kind of key, aren't we?
Exactly.
To unlock these principles of control, hierarchy, isolation, things that you see playing out in pretty much every major political or commercial hub throughout history.
Okay, so let's start with our guide. Who exactly was Nigel Cameron?
Right. Nigel Cameron. He lived from 1920 to 2017. He was a distinguished Scottish writer, art historian, and also a photographer.
Yeah.
But what makes him really interesting, I think, is his background. He wasn't just an academic. He was a genuine Asia specialist. He spent huge chunks of his life actually living and working across Asia, especially in Hong Kong and China.
Ah, so that hands-on experience, that's the key thing here, not just studying it from afar.
Absolutely. That's the differentiator. He wasn't just, you know, looking at blueprints or old records in some dusty university library.
Yeah.
He had this blend of like rigorous academic history combined with this almost journalistic immersion. It gave him a really intimate feel for the daily life, the political nuances inside the system.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes his book on the Forbidden City so valuable, I think, is that he doesn't just see the palace as like a static museum or just a collection of art objects.
Right.
He sees it as a living, breathing organism of power. That's his phrase.
I like that.
Yeah. And he connects these incredibly subtle cultural details, like the exact angle of a walkway or why a specific piece of jade was chosen. He connects those to the huge political and cosmological ideas that define the entire empire. He's showing us not just what they built, but why it absolutely had to be built that specific way.
Which brings us right to the book's main idea, doesn't it? Cameron basically argues the Forbidden City isn't just, you know, a bunch of impressive buildings. It's like a 3D philosophical statement.
Exactly. A physical manifestation of Chinese cosmology.
Right.
All meticulously designed to reinforce the emperor's legitimacy, the mandate of heaven.
Okay, maybe we should quickly define the mandate of heaven for anyone not familiar.
Good idea. So it's this ancient Chinese concept, basically saying the emperor rules not just because he inherited the throne, but because heaven allows it. It's like a divine contract.
Right.
If the emperor governs well, keeps things harmonious, he holds on to the mandate. But if he becomes corrupt or things go wrong, like natural disasters, famine, or successful rebellions, that's seen as heaven withdrawing its blessing.
So the emperor constantly needed to prove, visually, ritually, that the mandate was still his.
Precisely.
And that's why every single bit of the Forbidden City, the bright yellow roof tiles, the strict north-south axis, it was all symbolic. It wasn't just decoration. It was, well, propaganda, designed to legitimize, even deify, the emperor as the son of heaven.
Yeah, it established a kind of mirror on earth of the heavens above.
Mm-hmm.
The whole site was aligned to the pole star, which was believed to be the absolute unmoving center of the cosmos. So by aligning his palace to that cosmic pivot point, the emperor was visually stating that he too was the crucial link, the pivot between heaven and earth.
Wow. Okay. And Cameron structures the book and kind of the palace itself as this journey, right? Moving between very distinct zones.
Yeah, a really stark division between the public and the private. You start in these overwhelming ceremonial spaces of the outer court. That's the realm of public power, the stage.
Yeah.
And then you move into the secret residential world of the inner court. That's where the real human drama played out.
Let's start that journey then. Where does it begin historically?
Well, the conception really starts in the early 1400s with the Yongle Emperor. He's the one who moves the capital to Beijing and commissions this colossal project.
Must have taken unbelievable resources.
Oh, absolutely. And total authority. It was a massive statement of political will, but executed using these really sophisticated cosmic design principles from the get-go.
You mentioned the north-south axis. Was it also about things like feng shui?
Definitely. It was planned according to ancient principles of feng shui, or any geomancy, and also numerology played a big part. Feng shui here wasn't just about, you know, where to put your furniture for good luck.
Right, it was bigger than that.
Much bigger. It was about aligning the entire city to harness beneficial cosmic energies to ensure harmony. That north-south axis wasn't just practical for layout, it was considered essential for channeling the flow of imperial energy and maintaining cosmic balance.
Okay, so this statement of power, where does it unfold most dramatically? You mentioned the outer court.
Yes, the outer court. This is the public, often described as the muscular heart of the empire. It's dominated by three huge halls built on a massive marble terrace: the Hall of Supreme Harmony, the Hall of Central Harmony, and the Hall of Preserving Harmony.
Let's maybe unpack those three halls a bit. Their sequence seems important for this performance of power you mentioned.
It really is. The Hall of Supreme Harmony was the biggest, the grandest, the throne hall. This was the stage for the absolute most important state rituals, enthronements, imperial weddings, New Year ceremonies.
And Cameron emphasizes the approach to it, right? The courtyards.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It was designed for pure awe. He talks about how visitors had to cross these enormous silent courtyards first. Courtyards capable of holding like 100,000 officials all kneeling.
No.
And that engineered emptiness, that scale, was genius. It guaranteed that everyone, no matter how high ranking they were back home, felt instantly small, insignificant, before they even saw the throne.
So you weren't there to chat. You were there to prostrate yourself.
Precisely. Then you have the Hall of Central Harmony, a smaller, actually circular space. This was like the emperor's private preparation room before the big ceremonies.
Oh, okay.
He'd go there to mentally prepare, maybe rehearse the rituals to ensure everything looked perfect when he was on the public stage.
And the third one, Preserving Harmony.
The Hall of Preserving Harmony. This was used for things like state banquets and, significantly, for the final stage of the Imperial Civil Service examination.
Ah, so it was kind of like the place that produced the administrators needed to run the whole show.
You could say that, yeah. It literally helped manufacture the bureaucracy that held the empire together.
Okay, but then there's a shift. You pass through a gate, the Gate of Heavenly Purity, I think.
That's the one, a very imposing gate.
Yeah.
And suddenly, everything changes. You enter the inner court. This is the private residential, often called the feminine domain, home to the emperor, the empress, and crucially, the imperial concubines.
And this is where Cameron uses that phrase, the gilded cage.
Yes, and it's so apt. It captures the paradox perfectly.
What's the paradox exactly?
Well, on one hand, you've got unimaginable material luxury. The finest silks, incredible artworks, beautiful gardens, armies of servants catering to every whim.
Sounds pretty good.
But on the other hand, there's this profound isolation, intense psychological pressure. These women, the empress and concubines, they were technically the most privileged women in the entire empire, but they were also, in many ways, the most imprisoned. Their whole lives revolved around strict protocols and this constant, often cutthroat competition for the emperor's attention and favor, which could determine their status, their future, even their survival.
The gilded cage indeed.
Yeah.
And who managed this intensely private world?
Well, overseeing it all were the eunuchs. This is where the sort of messy political reality starts to complicate the perfect cosmic ideal of the palace design.
How so? How did they become so powerful in a system designed for divine order?
It was almost a necessary consequence of the system's isolation, because no other adult males were allowed anywhere near the inner court.
Only the emperor.
Only the emperor. So the eunuchs controlled all access to the emperor when he was in his private quarters, and also to the empress and concubines. They started as servants, basically, palace staff. But over centuries, they evolved into this incredibly sophisticated, often immensely powerful parallel bureaucracy. They managed the imperial household, gathered intelligence, acted as intermediaries, and often became the emperor's closest confidants, his eyes and ears. And sometimes, yeah, his hidden political agents. Their influence could sometimes eclipse even the official grand secretaries in the outer court.
So the Forbidden City wasn't just palaces and courtyards. It was a whole world in itself.
Absolutely. A self-contained ecosystem, A city within a city, really. Cameron talks about the Imperial workshops right there on site, producing things like that exquisite, exclusive Imperial porcelain you only saw in the palace.
Right.
And the beautiful, tranquil Imperial gardens, designed according to Taoist principles of harmony with nature, they offered a kind of quiet, contemplative counterpoint to all the rigid ritual and political maneuvering going on elsewhere.
But that perfectly ordered world, that facade, it couldn't last forever, could it?
No, nothing does. Cameron traces the gradual decline of the imperial system, and it culminates really in the figure of Puyi, the last emperor. It's quite tragic.
What happened with him?
Well, after the 1911 revolution, the Qinga dynasty collapsed, the empire was gone, but Puyi, who is just a child, was allowed to continue living in the inner court for several years.
Wow.
Yeah, effectively a prisoner in his own palace, still surrounded by eunuchs and rituals, playing at being emperor in this strange limbo until he was finally forced out in 1924.
That transition from being the divine center of the cosmos to just a historical artifact and then eventually the palace museum we know today, that's a huge shift in meaning.
A profound shift in the city's identity. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, before we jump into the main themes, let's quickly revisit that comparison we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
We've got Beijing, land-based, ritual, cosmic mandate. How does Malacca offer a contrasting center of power?
Right. Well, if Beijing was designed to face the pole star, to align with the heavens, you could say Malacca was built to face the sea. Its power didn't come from divine isolation and ritual. It came from its absolutely crucial strategic location.
Geography is destiny kind of thing.
In Malacca's case, very much so. The Sultan's court, while obviously much smaller and different from the Forbidden City, was the vital nucleus of maritime trade for the whole region. Why? Because it controlled the Strait of Malacca, the single most important shipping lane, the choke point between the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea.
So control the strait, control the trade.
Essentially, yes. And the Malaccan court projected its authority in different ways than Beijing. Less through cosmic ritual, more through really clever diplomacy, playing major powers like Min China and Siam off against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And also by maintaining a remarkably open, cosmopolitan, multicultural trade policy. It welcomed merchants from everywhere, India, Arabia, China, Java. So its power was based on flow of goods, people, ideas, whereas Beijing's power was fundamentally based on control, order, and a kind of symbolic stasis.
That's a great contrast. Both crucial centers radiating influence, but built on totally different principles.
Exactly. And understanding both helps us see the different ways power can manifest.
Okay, so pulling back to the Forbidden City in Cameron's analysis, what are the big overarching themes that stick with you?
Well, the first one has to be theme one, architecture as cosmic order. The Forbidden City is just undeniable proof that the built environment is a political statement, a philosophical document made real.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of reminds you maybe to pay more attention to how our modern institutions, you know, think about massive bank headquarters, government buildings, sprawling tech campuses. They still use scale, materials, access, security to convey their own versions of power, legitimacy, or maybe exclusivity.
That's a great point. We still build our beliefs into our buildings.
What's next?
Theme two, the duality of public spectacle and private seclusion. That stark contrast we talked about between the perfect, rigid public performance in the outer court and the hidden reality of the inner court. The intrigue, the loneliness, the fear.
Yeah, the gilded cage again. Exactly. It's a timeless lesson, isn't it? Power often demands this flawless public facade, but behind it, there's often a heavy human cost. It tells us something about the burdens of absolute authority, even today.
Mm. And a third theme.
I'd say theme three, the enduring power of symbolism. The emperor's authority wasn't just based on armies. It was deeply tied to the symbols that constantly reinforced it.
Like the yellow roofs.
The yellow roofs, reserved only for imperial structures. The five-clawed dragon, another imperial symbol. The specific number of steps, the direction things faced, the kneeling courtiers. None of this was accidental.
Right.
It was incredibly sophisticated political branding, you could call it. And it worked. It sustained the system for half a millennium.
Cameron really captured that synthesis of culture and power so well. He left us with some really memorable lines or ideas, didn't he?
He definitely did.
Let's share a couple. I really like the one that gets at the core design principle. The Forbidden City was not merely a palace, but a terrestrial diagram of the cosmos, with the emperor as its living divine center. That just sums up the sacred geometry of it all.
That's a perfect one. And then reflecting that human cost we just mentioned, there's within the inner court, immense privilege was inseparable from profound isolation. It was a gilded cage from which there was no escape.
That hits hard, thinking about the lives lived in there.
It really does. And maybe one that bridges our two locations. You mentioned Malacca's dynamism, its fusion. There's that idea, maybe not a direct quote from Cameron, but capturing the spirit. In Malacca, you can taste 5 centuries of globalization in a bowl of Laksa.
I love that. It's such a vivid metaphor, isn't it? How cultural mixing creates something totally new, yet you can still sort of sense all the historical ingredients that went into it. Like Beijing and Malacca themselves, different ingredients, different results, but both centers of immense influence. So these insights aren't just historical curiosities, are they? How can we apply some of this thinking today?
Oh, absolutely relevant. Take modern leadership and isolation, that whole gilded cage concept. It's a really powerful warning for anyone in a position of power today.
How so?
Well, any leader could be a CEO, a politician, anyone who cuts themselves off from honest feedback, who surrounds themselves only with people who tell them what they want to hear.
The yes men.
Exactly, the sycophants. They risk losing touch with reality, making terrible decisions, just like some of the isolated emperors did. Shutting down dissent, however uncomfortable, is often the quickest way to fail.
That makes sense. What else?
Well, think about strategic design and branding. We talked about the emperor's use of symbols like the dragon and the color yellow. That was essentially an extreme, very deliberate form of political branding. Today, corporations spend millions, billions on logos, on carefully crafted public images, on the architecture of their headquarters. Politicians manage their image relentlessly. We're still using design and symbols to project authority, stability, innovation, whatever it is we want people to believe. Maybe just with glass and steel now instead of carved wood and yellow tile.
We're still building myths around power.
In a way, yes. And finally, those geopolitical lessons from Malacca. They seem incredibly relevant today. Malacca's success wasn't just about its amazing location, controlling that strait.
Right, you said there were other pillars.
Yeah, at least three. That strategic location, yes, but also really smart diplomacy, balancing relationships with bigger neighbors, and crucially, fostering that open, welcoming, multicultural environment for trade. Those principles, strategic positioning, savvy diplomacy, and openness, they still feel like the fundamental ingredients for success in international business and strategy today.
It's amazing how these historical examples continue to resonate. So as we wrap up this deep dive, what was one thing that maybe surprised you most or stayed with you?
For me, I think it's the sheer psychological weight of that contrast between the outer and inner courts, the gap between the flawless public performance of power and the probable loneliness and pressure felt by the person at the absolute center of it all, the emperor. That human drama inside the perfect architectural machine, it's quite stunning when you think about it.
Yeah, that really struck me too. And I guess my final thought, maybe a provocative one for you, the listener, is this. Cameron's work in studying places like the Forbidden City or Malacca teaches us that these great structures, these historical centers, are so much more than just stone and wood or geographical points on a map.
Mm-hmm.
They're like containers for huge political and philosophical ideas.
Mm.
And we really need to look beyond just the impressive facade or the strategic location and ask, why was this space built this way?
Mm.
What ideas was it meant to project? Because understanding those often forgotten narratives, I think it genuinely enriches how we understand power, influence, and even globalization today. It reminds us that being interconnected across vast distances, well, that's definitely not just a modern invention.
Well said.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.